We mentioned in our announcement a little about what happened from 1999 to the present. I think you might be interested that prior to that, and this by way of qualifying the witness, Elner Hill had a very distinguished career at Florida State as an undergraduate and as a JD graduate from the College of Law, magna cum laude in all of them. And from 1975 to 80, she was a federal prosecutor, an assistant U.S. attorney, dealing especially as special attorney with organized crime, the organized crime section in the Department of Justice. And here she got substantial grand jury and trial and appellate experience. From 80 to 85, she was associated with the United States Permanent Subcommittee on Investigation, where she conducted numerous domestic and international congressional investigations and hearings on subjects that ranged from technology transfer to drug enforcement to organized crime and a whole host of subjects. And in that capacity, she also served as a principal advisor to Senator Nunn for purposes of his tenure in the Senate Select Committee on in connection with his service as military service on the secret military assistance to Iran and Nicaragua case. And then finally, from 85 to 95, she joined, gained extensive investigative experience in both executive and legislative branch as Inspector General for the Defense Department, where she managed a wide range of criminal and administrative investigations, including combating waste, fraud, and abuse throughout the department, including military departments, and gained expertise in such areas as defense procurement fraud, health care fraud, information security, and so on. So in all of these respects, and her preparation has been significantly tailored to the position of great importance that she holds now, and she can say as much as she wishes about the particular report which she's working on up to the moment. So it's a great pleasure to hear lessons on September 11th.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you for those. Thank you. Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here, very honored to be here. I have been past Charlottesville before, but I don't think I've actually been on the campus of the university before, so it's a real treat. And I have just sent my husband and 10-year-old son off on a grand tour. Hopefully this will impress our 10-year-old sufficiently so that he will want to return here at a later point in his life, hopefully. But at any rate, before I get started, I have one mundane thing. Someone very graciously took my purse as I came in. I need it back because my reading glasses are not in here, they're in the purse. So. And I think I know this well enough to do it without my glasses, but just in case. When Ken first called me about this, thank you. When he first called me about this, here they are, about this presentation, I think it was several months ago, and at the time, when we picked out the date, June 23rd sounded awfully far away to me, and it also, I thought, well, that will be a safe bet that we will be finished with our ongoing, I should call them negotiations with the intelligence community on declassifying the final report of the joint inquiry on September 11th. And I had hoped that that would be done, so when I came down here this morning, I could give you the full range of much of what we have seen in the last year in our inquiry and also what the committees found, because I would be able to talk to you based on the full entire declassified report. And I should tell you the report, This is the final report of the committees, and it was voted on and approved without even a single dissenting opinion, which is considerably amazing to me, having worked in the Congress for years and knowing that we had 37 members of both the House and the Senate, and they all agreed on that report. This was last December, December 10th to be exact, when they voted the report out. The report is almost 900 pages long. It's a very long report, and it was voted out on the 10th of December. I believe it was filed within the week with some amendments and, you know, making sure we had everything right. We filed it in the Congress within a week, and on the same day, I personally, along with my deputy, hand-delivered it to the CIA with the request that they begin to declassify the report. I thought at this point in time I would be down here for a nice visit to Charlottesville, have several days to spend down here with my family, and hopefully I would be taking some time off and not working in the Senate and the House anymore, at least for the summer. That's not the case. I'm still there, and I'm going back tomorrow morning to start again tomorrow morning on our continuing negotiations. The bottom line is we have not yet succeeded in getting the report declassified. I can tell you we are extremely close. It has been a very long, tedious process. The agencies, and I'm skipping a little out of order here to tell you this, and then I'll go back to what I can tell you about what we found, which is considerable. The CIA is leading a team, I call it a working group, of professionals from the various agencies that our report touches on, and that includes principally the CIA, the National Security Agency, NSA, the FBI, and others. There are references to the Department of Defense, to the Defense Intelligence Agency, to the Treasury Department, to the State Department, so there are a number of agencies that are affected, the main ones being NSA, CIA, and FBI. That working group has been going back and forth with us over much of the last seven months now, trying to get this report declassified. But even in the best of all worlds, it would be an extremely hard, tedious process because it entails going through every page of that report and tracing where we picked up each piece of information and whether or not to disclose it would adversely affect sources and methods for the intelligence community and national security. The members, and you may have heard some of this has been in the newspapers, our leadership have been very frustrated by the pace of this process. They have been vocal at times with their disenchantment with the process, and as a result, and also as a result, I should say, of the very hard work, not only of our staff, but of the community and the intelligence community, individuals on the working group, we have made a lot of progress. And I will tell you, we are down to within, optimistically, but not as a guarantee, within weeks of getting this report declassified and released, hopefully. So, as much as I would like to be able to talk to you about everything this morning, I'm unfortunately still limited to talking to you about what has been publicly discussed in our open hearings and what we released as the declassified findings and recommendations last December. But hopefully within a few weeks you'll be able to read as much as you want in great detail of the rest of our work that up to this point is still classified. So, with that as a preface, let me just tell you a little bit about what the inquiry did and what we found, and then I guess we would open this up to questions and discussion. As I said, I had planned to have been gone by now, but I'm still there. I started with the inquiry last June, so it's been about a little over a year. I actually, at the time, was in private practice, and I was approached by coming to the committee. At that point, they had already started. They were several months into it, and the leadership asked me if I would join the effort as the staff director. And frankly, I confess I do very much enjoy working in the U.S. Congress, and I've done it for many years, and I find it absolutely fascinating. So that was one draw for me. The other one, I do love doing investigations. That's what I've done most of my career, so that was another draw. And the final one was that I felt, as I think most Americans feel and felt and still feel, that September 11th was really an event, a cataclysmic event for this country. And I really felt that the American people deserved to know as much as they could and as much as we could tell them, given national security restrictions, of how their government and how their intelligence community performed prior to 9/11, and basically what went wrong, why we didn't know more than we did, and why we weren't able to prevent that horrible day in September of 2001. So I felt it was something that was obviously very much worth doing and very important to do. So how did we do it? This whole inquiry began as an idea of the two chairmen of the two permanent intelligence committees of the Senate and the House. It was a historic effort in that it was the first time that I believe, and I have had this told me by our chairman and Senate historians, it was the first time that two permanent select committees of the Congress, of the House and the Senate, came together with a single staff in a bipartisan unified inquiry. Iran-Contra, which Ken mentioned to you and I worked on back years ago in 1987 for Senator Nunn, was an effort of two special committees that were created, and it had two separate staffs. It was a bipartisan effort because we had Democrat and Republican staff. This effort that I just have spent the last year working on was something quite different. It was two committees, both intelligence committees, that are there permanently, have been there for years. They are existing committees. They have their own staffs. They went out, they hired a professional staff, a single staff. There were no Democratic staffers, no Republican staffers. We were all working for four individuals, basically. The chairman and ranking member of the Senate committee and the chairman and ranking member of the House committee. And those four came together, and I will tell you because I was there with them, many, many times I met with the four of them, and the decisions that guided that committee and that inquiry were a product of the four of them coming together, and I think recognizing that September 11th and what needed to be done was so important that we really had to put aside the usual partisanship, the usual divisions, and do this as a single effort. And that's what we did. It was fascinating. It was frenetic from the day I got there. It was very fast paced. We had a tremendous amount of work to do, but I enjoyed it immensely, and I think all of us felt that what we were doing was something very worthwhile. The four leaders, I do want to give them full credit because they were, very supportive of our work and gave me all the access and all the support and all the backup that I needed. They were on the House side, Porter Goss, who is still the chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the House, and Nancy Pelosi, who you may have heard many things about lately because she is now the minority leader in the House. She was, during the course of this inquiry, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. On the Senate side, it was Senator Bob Graham, who was the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He rotated off the committee at the end of the year, so he's no longer chairman, but he was during this inquiry. And also Senator Richard Shelby, who also rotated off, but was at the time the ranking Republican on the Senate Committee. So the four of them came together to do this. What was our task? It was three things, basically. The first was, what did the Intelligence Committee know, or what should they have known about the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th before September 11th? That was a factual question. Could we find out? Did the government have any reason to know that this was going to happen? Did the intelligence community have information that could have prevented this? That was our first task. The second task was to find out what systemic problems, what shortcomings in the intelligence community contributed to the fact that we didn't know enough to have prevented this. What problems, if we fix them, could help us to better be able to predict these sort of things and to stop these sort of things in the future? And the third was basically to make recommendations based on what we found out in terms of systemic problems and facts. To do that, we had 24 staffers. Most of them were all professionals. Many of them came from the intelligence community, the law enforcement communities, private sector, think tanks, and a variety of individuals. What did they do? They spent a great deal of time. They started in April of 2002, and our first public hearing was in September of 2002. We had closed hearings over the summer, but the investigative work started in April, and they did a tremendous amount of work. They requested and received documents throughout the intelligence community. They reviewed 500,000 documents from the intelligence community, as well as some agencies and departments that were beyond the formal intelligence community. DOD, I mentioned, although parts of DOD are in the community, others are not. The Transportation Department, the Treasury Department. So we had some other documents also. But the prime producers of documents were, of course, CIA, FBI, and NSA. 500,000 documents, 600 individuals were interviewed, either interviewed in briefings or meetings. Individuals from all across the intelligence community, from other parts of the federal government, and from individuals who represented state and local authorities and members of the private sector. So it was all kinds of individuals. What was the result of all that? The result was we had a series of hearings. We had 9 public hearings. You might have seen some of them. C-SPAN carried many of them, if not all. Those were last fall. That was, I think, unprecedented for the intelligence community in committees in recent years because, frankly, most of their hearings, because of the nature of what they do, are held behind closed doors. But we did have 9 public hearings. We also had 13 closed hearings. There were many issues that we could not discuss in a public forum because of national security considerations. So we had 13 closed hearings. Part of what is taking so long in this report is the fact that the report itself covers both the public hearings and the closed hearings. So it also covers a lot of the very highly classified material. And some of that obviously will never come out in terms of a public report, but some of it we're working very hard to see that it does. So that was the result of the hearings. What did we find? Part of the problem with talking about our inquiry is that we found so much and there was so much information we amassed that it's very difficult to get to the main issues and the main focus. And I have thought about it for quite a long time, and I'm going to give you some of the details of what we found, not all of it, because it's simply too much in the time we have this morning, and I doubt you'd want to hear all of those details, but they will be in the report. But I will say at the outset that really what we found, I think, we found a lot of problems clearly in the community. And I think they fell into 3 general sort of categories. And as I go through them, you can see where that's true. 1, we found a lack of what I call access to information. We found individuals that needed certain intelligence that didn't get it for a variety of reasons, okay? Information that was important or could have been potentially important in terms of September 11th. So there were access problems. Secondly, there was also what I call lack of focus. When the community did have certain information, they didn't focus on the significance of that information. And in particular, they did not have enough focus on the threat to the domestic United States. Those of you who have looked at the intelligence community issues know that the intelligence community really, as it was first envisioned back in 1947, the intelligence agencies were designed to look at foreign intelligence, what was going on overseas, to protect the United States from foreign enemies. There was a great feeling in this country, and I think it still exists, and it's obviously why, and there are many good reasons for it, is that Americans do not want other Americans spying on Americans. So there has been a real tendency not to view any need for a domestic intelligence agency in this country. And because of that, the bulk of our focus, and we found this was very true in the 9/11 inquiry, The foreign intelligence agencies like CIA, NSA, their mission is normally looking overseas to find out what the foreign threat is, the foreign intelligence. They do not look, for a number of legal reasons and cultural reasons, at what is going on in the United States. The one agency who was supposed to be looking at what is going on in this country, not so much in terms of intelligence, but in terms of law enforcement, was the FBI. And we found, and I'll go through some of them, numerous problems with that capability, with the focus, the amount of focus that the community as a whole had on what the threat to this country was domestically in terms of attacks, strikes against Americans in the United States. So that was a lack of focus problem. And the third problem, frankly, was what I would call a lack of quality. There were major problems that we found, and it's reflected in the report, in terms of quality, lack of quality in both analysis of intelligence, and I'll talk about some of the findings in analysis, and also investigations, our intelligence inquiries, our intelligence investigations. Could they have been better? Could they have been more thorough? Could they have been more aggressive? Could the analysis have been more aggressive, more creative, more putting the dots together? And you've heard that. That was the phrase that people talked about when we did this inquiry. But there's a lot to that phrase. It's creativity. It's aggressiveness in thought and analysis, those kinds of things. And for the large part, we didn't find a lot of that. We found problems in quality, in aggressiveness, in creativity, in investigation, in analysis, and other areas. So those are the three main sort of categories that I think most of this falls into: access, focus, and quality. So what specifically did we find? And I'll run through them fairly quickly, and then we can go to questions. The first thing we found, and this was a lot of the media had focused on this, a lot of the public had focused on it, and we have some factual findings in our report which really talk about what did we find in terms of facts. And the first factual finding is we found at least, no smoking gun, quote. And by that I mean we found no single piece of intelligence information that said on September 11th there will be airplanes that will dive into the Pentagon and the World Trade Centers. We found nothing specific that said on this day, this event will happen at this time, at this place, in this manner. So there was no specific smoking gun. My own view, based on my own background as a prosecutor, having done criminal investigations, having done congressional investigations, and the intelligence area from Iran-Contra and from this, is that truthfully, most of the time you don't have a smoking gun. And in my own opinion, it's a lot more important that our intelligence community has to be able to produce and put together the intelligence in the normal scenario, which is the scenario where they don't have the smoking gun. If they have a smoking gun, frankly, that makes it a lot easier. It's a lot harder when you don't have one. And unfortunately, most of the time, particularly when you're dealing with a group like Al-Qaeda, which is very sophisticated, very concerned about operational security, you're not going to have a smoking gun. So having said that, that was our first finding. The second finding was that there were a lot of indicators, all right? And I'm going to run through some of these. What we found in the intelligence, which was by our review of information. The first one was that we found that there was, during the spring and summer of 2001, a high, very high, probably unprecedented threat level against this country in terms of the domestic threat, the threat against the United States and United States interests by Al-Qaeda. We had intelligence professionals tell us they had never seen so much intelligence coming in about a foreign threat during that time period. And this was the time period of running about from April 2001 through the summer, leading up to September 11th. And I will tell you, having looked at those threats and having looked at the information, some of which we were able to declassify and put out in the public hearings, it is frightening. It is very serious. It strikes you when you read it that it's hard to believe that there can be that many zealots, that many people in the world that really want to do such serious harm to Americans, but they exist and they are there, and it's a very real threat. And the community was seeing that during the summer and spring of 2001. Second, there was also considerable information. It was modest compared to everything else, but it was very steady, and it had been from probably 1998 onward, that it was not just a threat against U.S. interests overseas, as our military installations or our embassies, that kind of thing. It was a threat against Americans in the domestic United States. There was reporting from as early as 1998, not only that there was a general threat, but Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda wanted very much to strike at Americans in this country. So there was a clear red flag there that the United States itself here was a target. Unfortunately, we found that despite that intelligence, most of the intelligence community was still focused on the threat being overseas. We had, for instance, testimony from the head of the FBI's counterterrorism effort in the United States, the assistant director in charge of counterterrorism, who told us in his testimony that in the summer of 2001, when the threat level was so high, he thought the chances of where it was going to be was that the attack would, there was a 98% chance that that attack would be overseas. 98% they thought it would be overseas, okay? So again, it's focused. They were focused on overseas even though there was information saying it would be here. The third one, and this is one there was a lot of discussion right after September 11th about that no one could have ever imagined that they would use aircraft as weapons. That why would we have thought that would have happened? Well, what did we find? We found there was intelligence from 94 through 2001. There were intelligence reports, again, not an overwhelming number, but they were there, indicating that terrorists, particularly bin Laden and al-Qaeda, had considered using aircraft as weapons, that this was a tactic that they had thought about using and seriously were considering. So again, the intelligence was there. Now, in addition to those sort of trends that were out there in the summer of 2001, we also found what the committee calls significant and relevant single pieces of intelligence that, in hindsight at least, were very relevant to September 11th. Unfortunately, what they also found was that the intelligence community failed to appreciate the significance of those pieces of information and failed to particularly bring them together and consider them collectively. And I'll read you what the wording is from the report. It says that although the community had relevant information that is significant regarding the attacks, the community too often failed to focus on that information and to appreciate its collective significance in terms of a probable terrorist attack. Some pieces of information were overlooked, some were not recognized as potentially significant at the time and therefore not disseminated, and some required additional action on the part of foreign governments before a direct connection to the hijackers could have been established. In other words, they didn't capitalize on the information. What was the information? And here I could go on and on, but I'll just give you a few high points. Hopefully you have heard of some of these because they were covered in the press. There were two hijackers, Khalid al-Midhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, who ended up on September 11th on the plane flight number 77 that crashed into the Pentagon. We found that the CIA had information on those two individuals, that they were connected to al-Qaeda, and that Midhar had a visa to enter this country, and later that Hazmi was also going to enter this country, and that information was in the community at the CIA for as long as 18 months before it was given to the FBI and before the individuals were watchlisted. The ironical thing is they did tell the FBI about these individuals. There was a meeting in Malaysia back in January of 2000, and the FBI was told about that, but they were never told that these individuals were carrying U.S. visas and coming to the United States until August of 2001, late August of 2001, which would have been August 23rd to be exact. So we had two individuals, and this was coming right after a very unprecedented threat level. It was also, and I'll get to it in a minute, in the same summer where some other information was out there. The community knew those individuals were out there. They knew they were Al-Qaeda operatives, and they had a very good idea they were coming to this country, and nobody raised the warning flag with our domestic agencies. Second piece of information was the Phoenix memo. Phoenix was an electronic communication. It was an FBI agent in Phoenix, and again, in the summer of 2001, July of 2001, put together a memo which basically highlighted his concerns that there was an inordinate amount of Middle Eastern students who he believed has associations with terrorist groups that were getting flight-related training in this country. That memo was never connected with Midhar and Hazmi coming to this country, and the third piece of information that I'll get to in a minute, Zacharias Moussaoui, who was picked up also in the summer of 2001 by the FBI as a potential suicide plotter, a potential part of a bigger plot using aircraft in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He was arrested, detained for immigration charges, and basically was being detained on September 11th when the attacks took place, and is now being tried or is about to be tried for a conspiracy to participate in the 9/11 plot. But no one at the FBI connected Moussaoui to the Phoenix memo, to Midhar and Hazmi, to the high threat level, to the aircrafts as weapons. So all of this is out there. Nobody puts it together. And what we found was that even within the FBI, not one person never saw all of this information, because I think in the words of the agent, the Phoenix agent who wrote the Phoenix memo, said that when he wrote it, he didn't expect a quick answer because he figured he'd send it to headquarters and it would sit at the bottom of the pile. And in fact, it did sit at the bottom of the pile in the summer of 2001. So those three are out there. Now I'll give you a couple others. Khalik Sheikh Mohammed, you may have heard about him. He was arrested in Pakistan. He is considered one of the most senior Al-Qaeda operatives and is now known, in hindsight, to have probably been the mastermind of the 9/11 plot. He gets credit or blame or infamy, whatever, for being one of the individuals who put this together and was the prime motivator with bin Laden. He's now in detention. However, he was indicted in this country in 1996, so he was under federal indictment on terrorism charges since 1996 in connection with something called the Bojinka plot, which was a potential Al-Qaeda plot that, in fact, would have used aircraft as weapons again. Mohammed was under indictment. He was overseas. The FBI and CIA looked for him. They could not find him, and he had not been detained before September 11th. What we found was not only had he been indicted and they knew about him, but they were so busy trying to find him. In other words, they were trying to capture him. They never really were trying to analyze what his role in Al-Qaeda was and what he was doing all these years and whether he was engaged in anything else that they should have been focused on. And in the summer, again, the summer of 2001, we found information in the intelligence community in June of 2001 specifically regarding Khalik Sheikh Mohammed. And that information basically said that he, at that point in the summer of 2001, had an active role in sending terrorists to this country, to the United States, and in facilitating their activities here in regard with terrorist activities here. So again, what happened to that information? Nothing before 9/11. They were looking for Mohammed, but no one was putting, again, analyzing, well, what is he doing? Where is he going in the United States? Where are these people going? What are they up to? Those kinds of questions were not being asked. And finally, there was also information we found, the hijackers. There were, as you know, 19 of the hijackers. And they had all been in this country for quite some time, a lot of them. This was not something that came in days before. They lived in this country. And what we found in looking at them, right after September 11th, there was a great deal of discussion by the community saying we could never have found these people because they were loners, they were isolated, They never came in contact with anybody of investigative interest to the community. Well, we looked at that and what we found, and there will be more of this in the report when it comes out, but I can tell you what's in the declassified bullet on this, which is that what we found in our inquiry, that in fact, those hijackers, at least some of them, a good number of them, were in contact with a whole number of individuals in this country during the time they were here. And, interestingly enough, some of the individuals that they were in contact with, they not only were in contact with them, they were assisting them and providing the hijackers with substantial assistance. Those same individuals, in some cases, had been known to the FBI as a result of FBI investigations and inquiries prior to September 11th, some of which, in fact, some of the same persons who were assisting the hijackers pre-9/11 in this country were, at the time they were doing that, under FBI investigation. So this raises questions of, it's not that they were loners. They were, in fact, being assisted by people in the United States who, at the time, were under counterterrorism investigation already by the federal government. And yet, that investigation didn't uncover the connection to the hijackers and what the hijackers were doing. So there was a whole lot of information out of there. What the committee found, committees found, was that all of that basically says that there were a tremendous amount of missed opportunities. It doesn't necessarily mean that had we connected all this, we would have absolutely been sure to stop the September 11th plot. A lot of people have raised the question, you know, you showed a lot of information out there. Well, so what? So what if they had all this information? Are we sure they could have prevented 9/11? And some people in the intelligence community will tell you that even if they had stopped Mihdhar and Hazmi at the border, that Al-Qaeda would have just sent two more people in, and we never would have been able to prevent this. And that may be the case. No one's ever going to know for sure, because it's obviously we're speculating. However, I think what the committees are saying, they did think about the so what question, and what they are saying is that had someone taken all this information and put it all together, and had the FBI known about Mihdhar and Hazmi, and had they, instead of just throwing them out of the country, had they done what investigators, good investigators, do, had they trailed those two individuals, had they monitored them, had they maybe gotten electronic surveillance on those individuals, who knows what they might have found? I mean, they very well might have been able to crack or unravel this plot. We don't know, and we'll never know for sure because we're, again, speculating. But certainly, I think what the committees are saying is, at the minimum, we would have been in a lot better position to have broken the plot prior to 9/11. And at the best case scenario, there is a possibility they could have broken that plot. They could have lucked out. They could have gotten information from surveilling them, from putting all this together, from looking at who Mohammed was sending into this country, and looking at Moussaoui, and maybe instead of detaining Moussaoui, maybe following and surveilling Moussaoui. That would have been another one they could have surveilled. So you don't know what they might have found, but the possibility is there. So that's the facts of what we found. Where did we go from there? And I will do this very briefly. We went into, we didn't want this just to be a post-mortem on mistakes of the past. We wanted this to be something that really looked towards the future. Okay, we know we made mistakes. What can we do to prevent this in the future? So we talked about a number of systemic problems. One was there was no priority in the community. There was no, the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, was either unwilling or unable to marshal all the resources of the community to really look at the problem of Al-Qaeda, to fight against Al-Qaeda, to maximize their resources. We found a very disjointed community. We found that the DCI, George Tenet, in the summer of 2001, was running around Washington, one of our witnesses said, pounding on the tables that something was going to happen, but he didn't know what. And what did he do about it? In December 98, he issued what we called a declaration of war. He said, we're at war with Al-Qaeda. I want no resource spared. That was very good and well-intentioned. Unfortunately, that was what George Tenet said. The message wasn't getting through to everybody in the intelligence community. We found at the same time that the field agents in the FBI who are on the front lines in places like San Diego, where Mihdhar and Hazmi lived, didn't even know there was a declaration of war. They didn't believe that in San Diego, Al-Qaeda was a priority. It wasn't their priority. They were doing other things. So there was a big divide. The director of NSA at the time told us that, yeah, he knew that George Tenet declared war on Al-Qaeda, but he thought that was only for the CIA. He didn't think that applied to NSA. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing we found. So it was a disjointed community. It was not prioritized, not focused. Analysis. We found a dearth, the committee says, a dearth of creative, aggressive analysis. There was no analysis, no assessment done of aircrafts of weapons as a technique, as a tactic. I already spoke about Mohammed. There was really no assessment or analytical effort on Mohammed. At the FBI, they had one strategic analyst focused on Al-Qaeda prior to September 11th. We had people like Sandy Berger, who was the national security advisor for Bill Clinton, tell us that the FBI, every time you ask the FBI about, well, what about Al-Qaeda here? Oh, don't worry, we got it covered, we got it covered. Well, we now know obviously it was not covered. So there were major problems with analysis, major problems with information sharing. Information wasn't being shared not only inside the intelligence community, like between the CIA and the FBI, but also when you know, intelligence is only, it's not only do you have to have good intelligence, you have to be able to get it to the people who need it in a timely fashion so that they can use it. And what we found is there were huge gaps in sharing intelligence outside of the community. The Phoenix memo that I just talked about, the FBI agent saying that he believes there's terrorists taking flight-related training in this country. We talked to the FAA and the Transportation Security Administration. The FAA never saw the Phoenix memo until 2002, after September 11th, when our investigators showed it to them. They never received it, okay? They never got it from the community. And they said, had they gotten it from the community, they have registries of people taking flight-related training in this country. They would have gone out and tried to marry that up with their knowledge of what's going on in flight schools. But they never saw it. In August of 2001, when the FBI finally learned about Mihdhar and Hazmi from the CIA, that they were in this country, they went out and tried to find them. And we had some very emotional testimony from some of the New York FBI agents who came to our hearing and testified, who basically recalled how they were angry and fighting with headquarters at the FBI, trying to put more agents on that search because they knew Khalid Mihdhar was a killer, that he was an Al-Qaeda terrorist, and yet they weren't able to put more people on it because they wouldn't put criminal agents on an intelligence case because of the wall between criminal and intelligence. There were those kinds of problems. But we had other agency witnesses testify from INS and from State Department and from the FAA representative. All of them said that in August of 2001, when the FBI was trying to find those two people, nobody from the FBI came to them and asked them to search their databases. The FAA, for instance, said, had we known that, we would have searched our reservations. We would have put them on the reservation watch. We might have stopped him when they made their reservations. We might have been able to find them. Now, whether they would have found them, we don't know. But the point is, none of their information databases were being used in that search. We had Baltimore police chief testify about how he doesn't know what's going on in the city of Baltimore in terms of the terrorist threat because the FBI won't share the information with him. We had Governor Gilmore, who had the former Virginia governor, testify that even as the Virginia governor, he did not get good intelligence information because he couldn't get cleared. They had security clearance issues. They wouldn't clear the state and local authorities quick enough to get the information. So there were all kinds of information sharing problems. This is just I'm giving you kind of a skip and hop look at some of what we found. And I know I'm going probably way too long, so I'm going to wrap up with a few things and then we can open it for questions. All of this fed into our recommendations. We had 19 recommendations, and all of this, I might add, are on the committee websites, the Senate and House committee websites for last Congress. So you can get all of the recommendations and the findings that have been declassified. I won't go through all 19 recommendations, but I'll tell you a few of them. One major one was that the committees recommended to create what they called a Director of National Intelligence, as opposed to the Director of Central Intelligence, and it would be one individual who had real budgetary management authority over the whole intelligence community, to not only to set priorities, but to enforce the priorities. And that individual could not be the same person that is the head of the CIA, because what we found when it's the head of the CIA and the head of the community, as is now the case, the rest of the community feels the CIA is being played favorites with, and also when the DCI says something, as with NSA, they think it only applies to the CIA and not to the rest of the community. So the committees thought one person, no CIA director, but a director of the whole community, have separate authority to enforce through budget and other means and personnel means the priorities that are set for the community. So that would be to unify the community and set real, meaningful priorities that are followed. The other thing we recommended, and the president is attempting to do this, and through something called TTIC, which is the acronym for the Terrorism Threat Information Center that he's recently created, we recommended an all-source fusion center for all counter-terrorist information. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not we're going to be spying on people and tramping on civil liberties, and that this is a major issue. Frankly, what we found, it wasn't that we didn't have all this information. The U.S. government has a tremendous amount of information. There's a wealth of all kinds of information. Problem is, it never gets put together in one place where people can really use it to complement each other and make the most of the information we already had. So what the committees recommended is, before you go out and get more information, let's take what you've got and let's use that, and let's create a fusion center where all that information comes in and is analyzed. And that is, I think, the intent of the new TTIC. There are other issues. We had a whole list of reforms for the FBI. I think the committees felt that the FBI was not being effective in looking at the domestic threat, and there are all sorts of information, all sorts of recommendations, everything from personnel, from beefing up analysis, to helping their technology. We found they had major problems that have been unanswered for years in their own internal technology systems, and that is a huge problem. So a lot of that is included. Director Mueller, I think, is trying to do some of those things, and I think is making good progress, but it is a major task. And also, the committees, because of the problems with the FBI, recommended that the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees seriously look at the question of what do we need to do about domestic intelligence. Can the FBI, if they make these improvements, really handle the job that needs to be done, or do we need to have another agency to do it? We didn't answer that question. It's a major policy question, but it has been teed up for the committees, and I know they are looking at it. Also, we talk about classification. Not surprisingly, the committees felt that the classification system needs to be reviewed with an effort to protect what really needs to be classified, but in the meantime, to get as much as possible to the American public and to people who need it in law enforcement and intelligence in a timely manner. So that, we found that was a major problem, and it needs to be reviewed. And accountability, what we did, congressional committees are not the preferred place for accountability investigations. I was an inspector general, and the inspector generals do accountability issues all the time. They do investigations of employees for all kinds of things. And I can tell you that when you do those kinds of investigations, they are very detailed, very focused on an individual and what they should or should not have done, because obviously you're dealing with individuals' careers and sanctions and those types of things. These committees did not do that kind of, we did the overview of the intelligence. We didn't look at individual culpability and do the kinds of things an IG would need to do to justify any kind of action against an individual. But what they did do in their findings and conclusions was they recommended and referred the record of our hearings to the inspectors general for those agencies. And those IGs are now, based on what we found, doing the necessary accountability reviews to see whether there are any individuals that should be held accountable for any sort of omissions or mistakes that that occurred with regard to September 11th. That, in a not too brief nutshell, is sort of my overview of the inquiry. In closing, I will just tell you it was an eye-opening experience. It was a tremendously rewarding experience from a personal standpoint, in that I think all of us that did this, we worked tremendously hard, but we felt it was worthwhile. We felt it was important. We felt the American people needed to hear this as much as we could tell them. And we hope, in a small way, we helped move not only the community, the intelligence community, but the American public and the whole country forward from September 11th, because obviously we do need to look forward. So, thank you.
In the few minutes that we have, let's try to hit big ideas. Let me give an example. What evidence is there that that World War II or after knowledge was put together? For instance, everybody in intelligence in World War II at one time or another came together at places like Camp Ritchie. Mm-hmm. And even if you were young and just barely heard of Donovan or Casey, mm-hmm. or all these people, mm-hmm. you met them, and the mm-hmm. culture kind of mm-hmm. developed as mm-hmm. a result. Mm-hmm. Is there anything like that that happens regularly in this area of intelligence?
You mean where they just kind of get together? Yeah. And
When you're retreading, there was always work to be done, but when you retread from German to Japanese order of battle, for instance, you got...
Right. When we had these hearings, and a big theme was information sharing, because the information was not mm-hmm. being shared, and they weren't mm-hmm. putting it all together. And we kept hearing about, we're doing a much better job. There have historically, for instance, between the FBI and CIA, been all kinds of divides over the years. I do know that prior to 9/11, if you talk to Louis Free and George Tenet, both of whom I know, and I know both of them have the best of intentions for their agencies, and I believe them when they say that on their level, they worked well together and they tried to bring people together and this sort of thing. But it's very hard when you have these huge organizations, even if the leadership gets together, to have this trickle down into the field where they're all out there, doing one thing. And then the other problem we have with when we deal with, and this was a case because it was domestic, where you had to have the FBI and the CIA plugged in together. It's not like the overseas thing. These are two agencies. One does domestic, one does overseas. You have this legal issue because you have the issue... Prosecutors they want to be able to take all this stuff and go to court with it. The CIA doesn't want you to go to court with it because they don't want to hurt their sources. So they want to protect their information from giving it to the FBI where it might end up in a courtroom. And, the worst thing would be if that got out and they don't want it in the courtroom. They want to be able to feed their sources and cultivate their sources. So you have legal problems. You have institutional divides. So the short answer is, yes, they are trying to bring people together. They are detailing people. In other words, they are putting people in each other's agencies to kind of cross-pollinate the cultures and sort of things. But what we found in 9/11, it just did not work. And the great irony of it, in terms of that, is that on the Midhar Hazmi story at the FBI, the individual who was a CIA, there were FBI agents and CIA people working together in the counterterrorism center. They all knew about this meeting in Malaysia and that Midhar and Hazmi were at the meeting. The person who was for the CIA, who we saw emails that he sent to the FBI and his back and forth confirming what he had told them, because he wanted to prove that he had told them all this, he's telling the FBI about all the stuff about Midhar and Hazmi, but he doesn't tell them that they have U.S. visas and that they're coming to the U.S. He's basically saying, we're handling it. These guys are bad guys. They had this meeting in Malaysia. But he never tells them they're coming into the United States, which is obviously what would have perked the FBI up, but he didn't tell them that. The irony is that this individual, he was in that job. His main goal in that job and his assignment was to improve communication between the FBI and the CIA. So, I mean, and that's why he was writing everything down to show he was talking to the FBI. Well, he was talking to the FBI, but he wasn't telling him everything, and he was leaving out the most important thing that they needed to know. So, it, you know, we had one witness who said, we really are working better together, we really are getting together and moving, but for some reason, everything just went wrong in this scenario.
Next question.
Will these reforms bring about, or your suggested reforms, mm-hmm. Bring about, will your suggestions bring about real change, or will the situation just get bigger and they'll continue, for the reasons you've already elaborated,
right.
Continue doing the same thing, but only a bigger scale?
Well, I think, you know, I probably believe that just the fact that September 11th happened, at least in the short term, is going to get some of the focus where it should be. Obviously, people are much more, they know now there's an issue there, and so they're much less laid back about this, and they're really energized. So that in and of itself, it's a bad way to have to get their attention, but it did get people's attention. Will the reforms work? I don't know. We're hoping they will. The Information Fusion Center, for example, we recommended this all-source fusion center. The president, based in part on what we said and recommendations from others, has set up this TTIC center, which is being led by the CIA, but the idea is to feed everything into the center. One of the complaints we got from a lot of different intelligence agencies was, we might get information, but all we get is the filtered finished product. We don't get the underlying, what they call raw data. And for us to put all this together, we need to understand what the raw data is, because we may miss something in the translation. So our recommendation says bring it all together, including the raw data, and get it to this group of analysts that can analyze everything and not just get filtered pieces. Well, they're creating a TTIC, but I still do not know whether they're getting the raw data, because George Tenet, for instance, testified at our hearing that there had been reports they were going to get raw data, but that's really going to be on a case-by-case basis. So that alone is a flag that this may still not be where we need it to go. So, you know, getting big bureaucracies to move and getting it to work the way it should work is a huge challenge, and you're probably never going to get it perfect, but you just have to keep pushing at it and pushing at it, and hopefully we're improving by orders of magnitude, we hope, over what we had. But there's certainly no guarantee. I mean, they are doing the right things. The FBI, for instance, is really focused on turning their agency around. Again, that's a big project, and it's got to be not just, they have to be doing what they're doing now, but they have to sustain that effort over the long haul and get their people to buy into it.
Here's a couple of questions from outside. Yeah. Would the 1993 World Trade Center bombing have been a wake-up call for 9/11 or the Philippine aircraft bomb plot?
Yeah, the Bojangles plot. Yes, and we said that both of them, in fact, I think our report says you would think that the 1993 plot should have been a wake-up call. But, you know, what we found, despite the 93 plot, not just plot, but attack, and despite Bojinka, which was aircrafts as weapons, that was 95 in the Philippines, you know, we had many people say they never really believed that it was like it can't happen here on the order of what happened on September 11th, that there was this view that this country was still insulated by these two great oceans, that we were protected and that whatever was going on overseas was ultimately not going to... I mean, I think that was certainly not everybody felt that way, but that was a prevailing view.
With the advent of Homeland Security, which does not include FBI and CIA, will the present intelligence investigation, weapons of mass destruction, etc., have the same thoroughness as yours did or better?
Well, I certainly hope it will. I have not been involved in the WMD look. That is, as you know, I think from reading the papers, being handled by the intelligence committees. I think both the House and Senate committees are looking at that. And all I can say is that both of those committees, they were our committees. They certainly, their members were prime movers in our efforts. So they clearly, I think they know how to do a proper inquiry. So hopefully they'll do a good job of what they're doing.
Charlie Smith.
From the standpoint of communications, do you see any, parallels in this act of terrorism and that of the financial terrorism that took place in the United States 3 years ago?
The financial terrorism, okay. What do you mean in communications between?
We had analysts in the stock market. We had Greenspan.
Okay, you're talking about the...
Yeah. Do you see similarities in the communication problems?
I have not looked in depth at everything that's happened on the analysts and the, but clearly, I mean, just from a broad brush, you could say that some of the analysts were not on point with what they should have seen coming, and they didn't see it, and obviously the analysts in the intelligence community did not see this coming. So I guess there are some similarities, although, as I said, I've spent the last year looking at intelligence at September 11th, so I've had very little time over the last year to be focusing in depth on what's happening on that aspect, other than pretty general knowledge, though. So.
Any other questions? Yes, French.
To the uninformed like myself, I was under the impression that we have the FBI, the CIA, and then the NSA, and that the NSA was supposed to coordinate the operations of the two FBI and CIA. As usual, I'm probably mistaken.
No, you probably mean the NSC, maybe, the National Security Council? The NSA, the National Security Agency, certainly works with the CIA and FBI, but they aren't the coordinating body. They are the what we call signals intelligence agency. Now, the NSC, the National Security Council, which is where currently run by Condi Rice and then by Sandy Berger under the Clinton administration, they certainly are, sort of overviewing what's going on counterterrorism and policy issues and government strategy. And Sandy Berger did testify for us, as did Brent Scowcroft, both of whom had been national security advisors. And we also had other information from the NSC, a lot of which will be more of it will be contained in the report when it's released. I think what Sandy Berger would have told you would be that he was trying to bring them all together, and they did have a counterterrorism working group going on under the NSA auspices, NSC auspices, National Security Council. And the idea was to focus everybody on what was going on, and that bin Laden was a priority. But when you talk to them, what you find out is that they would come together and they would have this group. And Berger, for instance, I believe testified that he would get a lot of intelligence from the CIA, but I think he described it as a trickle from the FBI on what was going on domestically. So there was an effort to bring it all together and coordinate it, but it was at a very high level. And what I think you find is it wasn't filtering down into the field. And truthfully, having worked in the field and having worked, in the policy area and in the management senior structure, when you're dealing with something like Al-Qaeda cells in this country, the field is very important because that is where you're going to really confront the enemy, not at the high management level.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Mine actually then relates to your last comment. In thinking of what you're suggesting, that if all of the defects are fixed and all of the recommendations are taken, it strikes me that this is a tremendous force toward the responsibility of the individual in the overall system. Is this something that you've thought about? In other words, the individual out in the field, there's individual responsibility rather than pure organizational responsibility in this new system.
Well, organizations and government is an organization, is really ultimately as good as the people who make up that organization and the government. And you cannot get around the fact that ultimately our, the product here and how well we do is going to be determined by the quality of the individual effort of the people who are making up those organizations. And this gets back to what I was talking about, would it have made a difference? Well, maybe had somebody been thinking enough and focused enough to put it all together and then gotten it to those agents in the field, and they would have thought enough to go get that information and pull it all together and find these guys. And then again, there's another if. Then you would have had to have agents that were aggressive enough and creative enough to want to tail these people and to surveil them and see if they could have broken the story. But all of that's a lot of ifs. But you know, it can happen. I mean, I was a prosecutor. I know, you know, I worked with some very, you know, excellent investigative agents in the federal government who made some very complex cases. They were committed to it and they were aggressive about it. And unfortunately, what I found when I looked at this case, I didn't see a lot of that. I saw, and maybe it was a product, you know, we had a CIA officer testify that it wasn't because the people weren't well-intentioned and competent and good people, but they were just overwhelmed. Maybe, you know, that's another part of this story. Another part of this story is that the intelligence, by compared to the, you know, we went from Cold War intelligence to facing an enemy that's all over the world, basically. And the flood of information is huge. I mean, they are getting a tremendous amount of information in. So now it's no longer a problem of trying to find scrapes of information. Now it's how do you find the needle in the haystack, you know? And maybe they were just overwhelmed. I don't know. But the bottom line is we need better systems, we need better priorities, we need less walls between our agencies, and we need very good, aggressive people to do this.
Last question, Knight Aldridge.
With the current restrictions in budget for executive agencies, did this affect the flexibility and the creativity of the agencies you were investigating?
Right. Yeah, we looked, there's a section, again, if the full report is declassified, there will be a section that talks about resources. We did look at the issue of resources because we had many people, particularly at the high levels, that would come in and say to us, this was all a resource problem. We just didn't have the resources. We got cut. We got cut. The intelligence community in the 90s went down. We got cut. So we looked at that. What we found, interestingly enough, was that it is true the intelligence community as a whole, the peace dividend, went down budget-wise in the 90s. However, counterterrorism went up. The counterterrorist effort was getting more money. The FBI particularly got a great deal of money. So there was a lot of funding in counterterrorism. Now, the agencies will argue that even with all those increases, it still wasn't enough. And, you know, given the scope of what they were facing, you can somewhat be very sympathetic to that. So, you know, the other problem we found is that it's hard to really see where the money was being spent in the intelligence community because of the way the budget is held and handled. And our report talks in more detail about that. But it's hard to really draw a hard, fast, clear line whether it was a resource issue. But, you know, overall, sure, I'm sure they could have used more resources. You can always use more resources in government when you're dealing with something as big as they were dealing with. But they did have more resources. They had not been, counterterrorism itself was getting more, even though the community as a whole had gotten less.
I have one word of explanation in closing. When we asked former students and friends in Washington, whom should we get to talk about this problem, they all said the same, gave the same answer, Eleanor Hill. And the same is true in a way for at least the Virginia community about our next forum on Wednesday. All said, if you want to deal with the Iranian thing, get the Ramazanis, so we have. And on Monday, a former PhD from UVA, who now is Freeman Professor at Georgetown, is going to talk about disease and SARS and all varieties in China. And then lastly, we asked whom would an audience most like to confront and learn points of view from, and everybody thought the French ambassador would fit this description. So those are the next four forums. However good the next three are, they won't be any better if it's good as the one we've heard today, and we want to thank Eleanor very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.